local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
This is the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. The Galileo spacecraft was launched on 1989, October the 18th, and went into orbit around Jupiter in 1995, December. Built to study Jupiter and its moons for 2 years, it eventually did so for 8 years. All good things must end, and so, in 2003 September, Galileo was deliberately crashed into Jupiter. The fiery plunge into the thick Jovian atmosphere completely incinerated the orbiter. Also cremated were any earthly microbes that might have stowed away on the unsterilized craft. This was important because there was the thought that if Galileo were to be abandoned in orbit around Jupiter, there would be a risk that the derelict craft could crash into a Jovian moon and contaminate it with earthly germs. As Galileo neared its terminal plunge into Jupiter, special commemorative events were held at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It was from there that the orbiter had been guided during its 14-year mission to the solar system's largest planet. At one of these events, public affairs officer Gay Hill asked the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for his thoughts on Galileo. Charles Elachi gave this response.
Let's move over to Dr. Elachi now, director of the Jet Propulsion Lab. Your thoughts?
Well, I think today we're here not to mourn Galileo, but really to celebrate, you know, the accomplishment and to recommit ourselves to build on its legacy and really move in our quest of exploration of our solar system and the universe on behalf of our nation.
Dr. Elachi, when you think of Galileo, what images, what thoughts come to your mind?
Well, when I think of Galileo, it's really the exciting discoveries that have made about Io, about Europa, and really have enlightened us about what the Jovian system looks like and build the foundation for our future missions, such as the Jupiter icy moon, you know, orbiter mission.
So from here, what next? What's the big picture?
Well, the big picture is we are moving in, continuing the exploration of our system, establishing permanent presence across the solar system, and also moving to our neighboring solar systems and start exploring them and say what's the differences and that similarity with our own.
On 2003, September the 17th, as Galileo was accelerated by Jupiter's inexorable gravity towards its demise, reporters were given an opportunity to ask a panel of three mission scientists questions. The three were Torrence Johnson, Rosalie Lopez, and Andy Ingersoll.
The top layer of ice is very cold. It's maybe 120 degrees, 130 degrees Kelvin. So ice is just like rock there. And when these thermal events happen and some kind of geologic upwelling that breaks it apart, okay, the dimensions of the pieces that are left basically reflect the thickness of the ice cap. It was much thicker. Those ice rafts that I showed in my graphic would have been much larger. And so from the size of the pieces, you can basically deduce what the depth is. And that turns out to be somewhere between 1 and 2 kilometers. It's really quite thin, the brittle part. Now, there is a controversy within the community about how far the ice extends down before it becomes liquid. And that ice, you might call it warm ice, because there's a temperature gradient that rises as you go into the ocean. That's not clear how thick that is. That could be 10 kilometers or 20 kilometers. It's certainly not grossly different from that. It's not 100 kilometers, which is the entire depth of the ice mantle, of the mantle. The reason why it must be liquid somewhere is because the magnetometer picked up these characteristic magnetic signatures of induced currents within that ocean. So I think that answers most of your question.
Catherine Drew with Channel News Asia. Sorry, an unscientific question, but Dr. Alexander, you seemed a little sad actually there when you were narrating the final hours. Is this like sort of crashing an old favorite car? And I have a second question. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the new mission. When does that begin?
I'll let Dr. Hartman address the second question. The first question,
actually think that back in November when we did the A34 pass was more like driving our favorite old car over the cliff, you know, and then the wonderful, you go after you drive it over the cliff and you turn the ignition and find out it still works. You know, we were able to basically anneal the tape recorder after it got hammered by going into the radiation belts and extract the data off of it. That was, in my view, one of our miracles from the mission. So we've put, you know, so much ingenuity. I almost think of it like a favorite car that you tinker with and you do this and that and you kind of, and then, and we're not going to be able to have fun with it anymore.
Luckily, we have already begun planning the follow-on to Jupiter, the next mission, and that's the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter. So it will launch sometime in the next decade. There's lots of planning involved. This will be our first nuclear mission. But the whole idea is when it comes to orbiting these moons and determining the ice thickness and characterizing the full moon to see whether there are upwellings, whether there are places where perhaps salty water breaks through the crust, you need to have an orbiter. And the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter will be so much more than Galileo in that it'll actually be able to spend months at each of these three moons, going from moon to moon, with instruments that are much more capable than Galileo brought, and communication back to Earth, because after all, we're not there with it. It's the data bits that get back to Earth that we scientists analyze to come up with these tantalizing results. So that will all happen in the next decade, the launch will. But the work for it has already begun to begin before the death of Galileo.
Any more questions here at headquarters before we move on to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory? Okay, we will come back again for another round if there's more. And we'll now go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena for questions. And please give us your name and affiliation.
Hi, this is Usha McFarlane with LA Times. I have one question for Dr. Alexander and one for Dr. Belton. The first is, Dr. Alexander, can you talk a little bit about exactly which instruments will be on until the end? And I understand the camera's off, right, so there won't be any visible images.
That's correct. Yes, the fields and particles complement of instruments will be on. That includes the plasma wave detector, the plasma science detector, the heavy ion counter, the energetic particle detector, and the dust detector. We will also be doing a radio science experiment will be on.
Can you give you information about Amalthea?
Oh, the star scanner is basically that's an engineering for attitude control. So that's why it was a little bit surprising to be able to see something with the star scanner that is related perhaps to the science of Amalthea.
Great. And Dr. Belton, obviously from your presentation it's clear there's great images and great science that have come out of this mission, but what do you think the difference would have been if, say, the high gain antenna would work? Would we have a lot more science and images? Would there be a lot more out there to discover that we might have in hand now?
First of all, I'd probably be dead from overwork. That'd be the first thing. We were expecting to have 100,000 images, and we knew that's what our project manager would allow us to take. We were expecting to get several times more than that. Basically, the difference would have been in the study of Jupiter, in which we were totally overwhelmed by Jupiter's size, so that with the very limited capabilities that we actually ended up with, our Jupiter experiments were really cut back. So we would have put a lot more emphasis on Jupiter. And then secondly, if not only the antenna hadn't worked, but if also the tape recorder had continued to work, we would have had wonderful pictures earlier on of Europa right at the time of first encounter with Jupiter, and also of Io. And that would have changed the whole way that we planned the study of the satellite, of those particular satellites. What we would have probably done, since Europa was a blast right from the very beginning, would have put a tremendous emphasis on Europa and increase the coverage for that particular part of the experiment.
Okay. We will now move on to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida for questions. And please give us your name and affiliation, and go ahead.
Hi, this is Chris Kreidler from Florida Today. Oh, sorry if that's loud. Not my doing. For Dr. Alexander, for a couple of times when Galileo passed close to Io and also close to Amalthea, it sort of went into safing mode or instrument shut down. And I wondered, this time, are you going to turn off the safeties, as it were? Are you telling it in a way not to shut down to protect itself since it's going to be destroyed anyway?
Actually, on the last bit, when we went back past Amalthea last time, we spent a lot of time disabling every safing mechanism that we could think of. And for those of you not familiar, safing is when the instrument basically goes into an emergency and it curls up into the fetal position, I think of it. And what actually happens is that the instruments go into their safe configuration and wait for commands from the earth. We've had, obviously, several such safing incidents over the history of the mission. But in order to continue to collect science data as we wind the mission down, the flight team began to disable a lot of these safing mechanisms. And on the last time, we had our fingers crossed that nothing was going to happen. But we were really hammered. We didn't disable every single safing mechanism. Some of them cannot be disabled. And sure enough, the spacecraft endured such damage that it did enter into safing. And it's my view that we will do the same thing this time around, that right around the same time we went into safing past Amalthea back in November, the spacecraft will also go into safing on this journey.
Robin Soriano with the Orlando Sentinel. For whoever would like to answer, I wonder if you could just put the science aside for a minute and talk about what the Galileo mission has taught NASA from an operations standpoint about operating a mission in deep space, and how those lessons are already being applied to current or nearby missions.
One of the things that we found in developing all of the different repairs to the things that happened to Galileo on its way to Jupiter and beyond was that there was a lot of value both in having flexibility in the operations personnel and being able to reprogram the spacecraft and having enough memory on board to develop fixes to things, like the safing events that Claudia was talking about originally began happening in the Galileo Europa mission, the first of the extended missions. And we actually developed software routines to work around those problems. When they happened, we would actually say, okay, ignore this particular instance of it and be flexible enough to identify what the problem was, develop software routines that would turn off that particular event when it happened. That very idea of having the flexibility and the time to solve problems while you're actually still collecting mission data is one of the things that for a long-term mission like Galileo or the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter is something that's very valuable. So having the resources and the personnel and the time to develop problem solutions is very valuable as well.
And if I might, I actually think of the Galileo mission as showing human ingenuity can conquer these kinds of technical problems. And as Jim said, as long as we have a robust software program and a robust spacecraft that can survive, human beings can come up with the workarounds and actually still get back very innovative and interesting science. In fact, the kinds of discoveries we talked about here today weren't expected at all. And so the very mission that had these problems through human ingenuity actually came back with these results, even though it had those problems. Outer space is not a benign environment. We expect to encounter problems. So it's up to humans then to send those commands to make the workarounds and still get the results back. So I think of it as just an incredible success story.
Okay, we have no more questions from Kennedy Space Center, so we'll come back here to do any wrap-ups here at NASA headquarters. First row over there.
My name is Naomi Lubick. I'm from GeoTimes. I'm wondering how many people in total actually worked on the project. It sounds like several generations of scientists went through this.
A tough question.
I've heard around 300 and something.
At one point in time, there were times when there was more than 300 people working at the same time on Galileo. There's probably closer to 800 that have cycled through the program one way or the other. And if you counted subcontractors that built piece parts, you might be in the thousands.
One thing you might note that because from conception through mission redesign, as Jim explained it, and then the problems that were encountered and overcome, we're talking about 30 years from conception through today. So there are people who have, in fact, spent their entire scientific or engineering career on this. So Sunday's quite, I think, an achievement day. It's not, it may be tinged with sadness, but in fact, it's an incredible human achievement.
May I comment on that?
Yeah, please do, Tom.
It has been a very long mission. It was 27 years ago when my colleagues and I wrote our proposal to fly on the Galileo mission. Now, 27 years ago, I had not yet celebrated my 25th anniversary, and none of my children were married. This year, I celebrated my 50th wedding anniversary. All my children are married. I have 7 grandchildren, 4 of whom are in college. And that gives you a little bit of a sense of the fraction of my family's life that this mission indeed has spanned. And it has been a wonderful, wonderful time, believe me.
Could I make a comment?
Please do.
Yeah, when this mission started, I had hair. But more seriously than that, what I really wanted to say was that those of us who are still here, really enjoying the fruits of this mission and trying to invent new kinds of science to follow it and to build on it. But there are many of our colleagues that didn't make it. And on my team, where I had initially 10, and it grew to the order of 25 people working with me, not counting all of the engineering staffs and so forth, we lost something like 6 people along the way, just because of the general length of the mission. And this is something that's very hard to take as you're trying to push this through and address all of these problems.
Hi, my name's Bill Ferries. I'm with the office of Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, but my father was one of the communications engineer, back when Galileo was being put together. I wanted to ask Dr. Hartman, you mentioned the follow-up mission to Jupiter, and I wondered, I think you said it would be in the next decade that would be launched. How long would it take to get there? When would we expect to have those probes in orbit?
Later in the next decade. So the launch date is sometime between 2012 and 2014 or so, and at the end of the decade we would be getting and analyzing results.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are reliving the end of the Galileo mission to Jupiter. And it's interesting to note that that replacement mission is now on its way to Jupiter. It's called Juno, and that's one of the reasons we're looking back 10 years to the end of Galileo. Now, Dr. Rosalie Lopez was a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She spoke to a public event in the Von Karman Auditorium about what travels, or rather about the travels of Galileo.
Now, not the highlight of the journey was the first ever asteroid flyby of the asteroid Gaspar in 1991. And, here you can see lots of craters and a surface that has a regolith that is dust from lots of impacts. And then even more surprising in 1993 was the flyby of the asteroid Ida. And this is the asteroid Ida that we knew about, but the discovery by, in fact, both the camera and NIMS of a satellite, a moon of this asteroid, and up to then, no one knew for sure that asteroids had moons. So this little fellow here got the diameter is, only 1.5 kilometers. So, you could easily walk across it. this was really a very fascinating discovery. And it ended up called Dactyl. There were some people on the project that really tried to find a mythological feature, a mythological creature called Ho, because then you could have Ida and Ho. And it looks like a potato, doesn't it? So finally, we got to Jupiter on December 7, 1995, and I remember that day very well. The Jupiter probe went into Jupiter. It had, in fact, been released a couple of months before. And the probe survived a lot longer than it was designed to, which was, you know, perhaps the first indication that Galileo was a really resilient spacecraft. I once talked to an engineer who worked on the probe and who actually worked on Galileo, and he said, well, those probe guys, you know, they kept margin they didn't even tell us about. So they really built it to last. So the probe was designed to measure temperature, pressure, density, composition. It actually, what was interesting, it entered in a very dry region. That is, it did not have much water vapor. Later, the NIMS data showed that the water vapor abundance, in fact, varies on Jupiter by orders of magnitude. And the probe also found greater amounts of carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur than expected, and that's important for particularly the people who study planetary formation, and detected strong winds and lightning as well. And I'm not, I'm an expert on surfaces, so I'm not going to spend much time on Jupiter and its atmosphere. But one of the nicest discovery was the discovery of ammonia ice clouds on Jupiter near the Great Red Spot. Now, the Great Red Spot is this enormous storm on Jupiter that's been raging for at least 300 years. And it's the largest weather system known. And, what NIMS found was this cloud of ammonia ice crystals that's here in blue. And this is, false enhanced color as well. This is produced by updrafts of ammonia-rich gas from deep inside Jupiter. So this helps, colleagues of mine who are trying to understand the meteorology of Jupiter. So the grand tour of Galileo started in 1995. We actually flew by Io for the first time in 1995, and that was a very hard time for several of us, particularly those of us who really love Io, because that was supposed to be the only ever Galileo flyby of Io. And the reason is that the radiation environment around Io is very hostile. If you were on Io, in one day you'd receive 4,000 times the radiation dose you need to kill you. So that's not very good for spacecraft either. So it was decided just to do one flyby of Io. And because of the tape recorder anomaly that I referred to earlier, the tape recorder stuck, project management decided against recording any Io images or any Io remote sensing data. So I had planned all these observations of Io, and I knew the sequence by heart, and I could tell that, the time on that day, this observation should have been happening. And in fact, the spacecraft still went through some of the motions, but the data were never recorded. Started the main mission, what we call the main mission, that ended in December of 1997. And we did distant observations of Io, which actually turned out to be very interesting, and close observations of Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. If we stayed further out, we knew that the risk of radiation wasn't so high. And then NASA actually extended our mission until December of 1999, and this was called the Galileo Europa mission. And we decided, well, okay, why not risk it at the end of the mission? Let's do two Io flybys and see if the spacecraft survives, which it did. And in January 2000, we started the Galileo Millennium Mission. In fact, we had a contest to name the new extension of the mission, and I won it by saying that if we named it the Millennium Mission, it could last a long time. And I won a free dinner. And between January 2000 and 2002, we did four other Io flybys, and the spacecraft still survived. And then the last highlight was the Amalthea flyby in November of 2002. And on Sunday, it will be Jupiter impact. So let's look at some of the highlights. These are the Galilean satellites. Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. In a nutshell, Io has hot volcanoes, this very colorful surface with lots of sulfur and no impact craters. Now, in the solar system, the longer a planetary surface stays around, in general, the more craters it's going to have. So if it doesn't have craters, it means that something has wiped out those craters. And in the case of Io, from the Voyager observations, we already knew it was volcanoes. But Galileo showed us a lot of new things. And then Europa, with few impact craters, an icy crust, and one of Galileo's major findings, possibly, you know, an ocean underneath this icy crust. Ganymede, the largest of all, with surface that is bright and dark. The bright surface is icy, the dark has more rock, it's rocky terrain. And Callisto, many craters and impact basin here. This is called Valhalla, which is 4,000 kilometers in diameter. So let's take a look at what we learned about their interiors, and this mainly from the magnetic field and gravity measurements. These are the radios. Ganymede, in fact, is larger than the planet Mercury. This is Io, about the size of our own moon. Europa, which is the smallest of the four, and Callisto. And what Galileo found from repeated flybys of these bodies, all except Callisto, have metallic cores surrounded by rock. Ganymede and Europa's rock layers are under shells of water that may be ice, may be liquid, may be slushy ice. Europa's surface layer, which is shown here in white, may be liquid water under a surface ice layer. Ganymede, in fact, was found to have a magnetic field and it's its own magnetosphere, which was kind of a surprise for a satellite. And Callisto, from Voyager observations, which had about this resolution, we thought that Callisto was a dead old world that you know, wasn't doing anything more and nothing more was happening on it. And you know, as the camera started getting closer images, this, in fact, you see more of these craters that are very typical of impacts on an icy surface. They look very different, for example, from the moon craters. And but the local view showed lots of smooth, dark material and evidence of erosion that we didn't actually realize was going on. NIMS data did some maps that showed surface compositional difference. This crater here is about 70 kilometers in diameter, and white is more water ice, the blue is less ice, and you see here as the crater excavates material, there is more water ice. The infrared data also showed sulfur and carbon as two possible constituents of the surface. Ganymede, here shown in enhanced color, it doesn't really have green or violet. The violets are the more icy parts. Shows a lot of tectonic activity, the bright, very grooved terrain and a dark, furrowed older terrain. And also a tenuous atmosphere and magnetic field. Now this, I like to show this because the imaging team named it as the hardest image to interpret of the whole Galileo mission. So don't be worried if you don't understand it. this is a terrain, part of the old dark terrain with lots of furrows. Mm-hmm. Deep furrows, and it's probably several billion years old. And they're not worms, even though they look like that. And I used to work with imaging data and before I joined Galileo, and I prided myself in being able to always tell in an image, planetary image, what side was up and what side was down. And when I saw that one, I was like, no, I can't tell. But in fact, there are deep grooves that you may be able to distinguish. Europa, one of the top discoveries of Galileo, is that it has a young, thin, cracked and ruptured ice shell that's probably moving slowly over a liquid ocean. And there are cracks and ridges. These brown features here that look like highways are in fact cracks. They can be thousands of kilometers long. There is what's called chaotic terrain, and I like to think of that as sort of hard to interpret. And that's mottled brown here. These are exaggerated colors. They exist where the surface was disrupted, cracked, and ice blocks moved around. And the NIMS measurements show that the surface may have hydrogen sulfate and or salts, and that would not make it terribly hospitable. But the discovery of this possible liquid ocean on Europa raised a lot of interest that this might be a possible place for life. And this is another very nice image of Europa that shows the interplay of colors and ice structures. There's ice here. You can see how it's fractured. And in fact, there are images of Europa that you can actually fit the blocks around like jigsaw puzzles and see where the surface cracked and these blocks just moved away from each other like ice flows. And this image is about 70 kilometers across. This white, a fine ice particle, in fact, that came from an impact long way away. And the reddish brown is surface that has been altered by minerals. And Europa, we think, has some form of ice volcanism, that is, flows of slushy ice that flow over the surface.
Rosalie Lopez describing the travels of the Galileo spacecraft. She was a research scientist working on the mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We will have more from this 2003 public lecture next week. And we must give a big, big thank you to Alan Walker for obtaining the audio inserts used in this evening's program and very nicely arranging it for us.
Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.